This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Sonia Shaw. Sonia is a science journalist and prize-winning author. Her writing on science, politics, and human rights has appeared in the New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs, Scientific American, and elsewhere. Her 2010 book, The Fever, was longlisted for the Royal Society's Winton Prize. Sonia Shaw is here today to tell us about her most recent book, Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond. Welcome, Sonia.
Thank you for having me.
What is your purpose or reason for writing Pandemic?
Well, in recent years, we've had a spate of new pathogens emerging. In fact, over the past 50 years, there's been about 300 new infectious diseases that have either kind of newly emerged or reemerged into places where they've never been seen before. So we have Zika going on right now, of course, but then in recent years, we've had Ebola in West Africa, where it hadn't been seen before, viruses like SARS and a new one called MERS that's coming out of the Middle East, new kinds of avian influenza, including one that hit North America last year and caused the biggest outbreak of animal disease in U.S. history, and then, you know, a whole spate of tick-borne illnesses, mosquito-borne viruses, et cetera. So this is sort of a global phenomenon that I wanted to look at.
Would you remind us of the definition of pandemic?
Right. So a pandemic is an outbreak of disease that starts in one part of the world and then spreads like a wave across continents and global populations.
And how common have pandemics been during human history?
They're pretty rare, actually, considering how many pathogens are out there, how many potential, you know, pathogens there are out there. Pandemics are actually pretty rare. In recent history, sort of modern history, we've only had maybe five pathogens that have been able to cause pandemics.
Why have you focused on cholera for your book on pandemic?
So I wanted to look at where these new pathogens are coming from. And so I did that sort of through a two-pronged approach. I looked at the history of one of our most successful pandemic-causing pathogens, and that is cholera. It has caused not just one or two pandemics, but actually seven global pandemics. And the latest one is ongoing right now off the coast of Florida and Haiti. So I wanted to look at how did this pathogen become so powerful, and what were the drivers that allowed it to cause these multiple pandemics over time?
What are the symptoms of cholera?
Cholera is a really horrible disease. So you get infected with this bacteria. It lines the interior of your gut, and it actually reverses the normal functioning of that organ so that instead of sort of nourishing the body with fluids, the cholera-infected gut will extract fluids from the body and expel them in a massive sort of torrent of waste that can be diarrhea or vomiting. And a person infected with cholera can lose up to 15 liters of fluid a day. So that's what actually kills you, is just this massive loss of fluids. People actually die of dehydration, and it can happen in a matter of hours.
Where did cholera originate or come from?
So the first pandemic of cholera started in an area known as the Sundarbans. This is in what's now Bangladesh. This is a giant wetland. It's where the rivers of South Asia kind of empty into the Bay of Bengal. And so cholera bacteria lives naturally in the environment there. It lives in marine environments all over the world, but particularly places like the Sundarbans, where the water is half fresh, half salty, and quite warm. So for a long time, people didn't live in places like that because, of course, the Sundarbans is a giant mangrove swamp. It's flooded by the tides twice a day. That all changed in the 19th century when the British Raj decided to cut down the Sundarbans and turn them into rice farms. And so that's when the cholera bacteria was able to jump into human bodies, and the first pandemic started from there in 1817.
How was it able to travel around the world?
So it was carried out of South Asia in the bodies of traders and soldiers, slowly up into Russia, up into Europe, the newly industrializing cities of Europe. Then it really caught a great break with the arrival of steam travel and rapid transatlantic shipping. So this allowed it to spread over the Atlantic into North America. And of course, a steam engine allowed it to travel much farther into the interior of North America, where we had steamships going up and down our rivers. We used steam engines to build canals that connected all of our rivers. The Erie Canal, for example, opened in 1825, right in time for cholera to kind of spread out of Paris and London into Canada and then into the entire interior of North America.
To what extent have human pandemics overall come from other animals?
So right now, we know that 60% of our new pathogens are originating in the bodies of animals. That's livestock and wildlife, mostly from wildlife. We have 70% of those are coming from wildlife. So it's when people invade wildlife habitat or disrupt wildlife habitat in ways that force wild species to come into novel, intimate contact with people that their microbes are able to spill over into our bodies.
How have changes in travel opportunities contributed to pandemics? You've said a bit about that already, but say more.
So certainly in the 19th century, you know, the arrival of the steam engine and the rapid shipping trade that flowed out of that was really critical to cholera spread. But today, of course, we do it in a much more efficient fashion with our flight network. We have not just a few airports in capital cities, but hundreds of thousands of airports in, you know, even small towns, and then tens of thousands of connections between them. So if a pathogen emerges in one part of the world, it can very quickly spread to the rest of the world. And this is really demonstrated in a nice way. I have a map in the book of different cities in the world on a map, not a geographic map, but a map that shows the connections of their direct flights. And you can actually predict when and where an epidemic will strike based on the number of direct flights between infected and uninfected cities.
In your book, you say that epidemics are fueled as much by social conditions as by introductions. Would you explain?
So it doesn't really matter if we have a lot of introductions of pathogens around. You know, we could actually live with that fine. If we don't offer the pathogens transmission opportunities, that is, by our own behavior, allow it to spread from one person to the next, then if we don't offer those opportunities, then the introduction of pathogens, it doesn't matter at all. So what you see is Ebola, for example, is a good example where we had a massive outbreak in West Africa just now. And that's because of the way people were living. People were living in very close proximity. These were very crowded slums in particular, but also in rural areas where people didn't have good access to clean water, to soap, to enough space to isolate people who were ill, not enough access to basic health care that could have helped with that process. So those are the conditions that allow pathogens to spread rapidly. Now, if you could have an introduction of a pathogen in a place where there was much better sanitation and electricity and running water and access to health care, and it would be much more containable.
Would you say more about how unsanitary conditions contributed to pandemics historically?
Well, in the 19th century, that's the main thing that cholera really exploited because, of course, the cholera bacteria, it infects your body, and then all of the waste that comes out of a cholera-infected person is highly contagious. Like, it's full of this bacteria. So if you even have drops of it on your hands or if it gets into your food or into your water in particular, then it can spread really explosively. And so in places like 19th century New York, you know, there's about 77,000 people per square kilometer in some of those slums in that time period. And that meant that people were really crowded so close together that they were, you know, touching each other a lot more. It's very difficult to isolate the sick, much more difficult to isolate and contain human waste. About 1/12 of the city of New York in the 19th century was covered in cesspools and outhouses, and there was no sewer system, there was no plumbing, there was no rules even that you had to empty out these cesspools. The material was just allowed to kind of sit and fester, spill out into the streets, run over into people's wells, and down into the groundwater.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sonia Shaw, author of the book Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. How has corruption contributed to the spread of pandemics? What are some examples?
Well, a great example took place in New York in the 19th century, where doctors at the time had noticed that cholera was traveling down the Hudson River and down the Erie Canal heading straight for New York. But the political authorities at the time didn't want to close down those waterways because it was considered too disruptive to trade. And so they didn't do anything about it. And cholera was allowed to come down into New York City again and again. And in fact, there was companies that were distributing cholera-contaminated water to the people of New York City. The center of a lot of the epidemics of cholera at that time occurred in a slum called Five Points, which some people might be familiar with from the Martin Scorsese movie Gangs of New York, which is actually based on Five Points. That slum had been built on what was once a pond that had been filled up with garbage, and the slum was built on top of it. So the groundwater underneath there was highly contaminated with all the waste from the slum above. But the company that was chartered to deliver drinking water to the people of New York, rather than tap upstream sources of water, which they knew would be cleaner and fresher and would taste better, to save money, they did sort of what the officials in Flint, Michigan did, which is that they tapped a much cheaper source of water, and that was this groundwater underneath the Five Point Slum. And they distributed that water to one-third of the people of New York. And this was through multiple cholera outbreaks.
How effective has the use of quarantines been to prevent pandemics?
Well, quarantine's a pretty kind of crude way to contain pandemics, to contain contagions generally. But, you know, there's evidence from historical literature that probably quarantines were helpful in containing certain pathogens in the past, like the plague, for example.
What were some of the problems in using quarantine?
Well, I think the main problem with quarantine is that people don't like it. So people get cut off, trade gets disruptive, and that can actually hurt a community more than it can help a community. I mean, we saw during the Ebola outbreak that, you know, a lot of other countries wanted to basically quarantine West Africa by shutting down flights that went into those affected areas, and that really harmed the ability of people to help contain. Aid workers, for example, weren't able to easily fly in and out of those countries. So in our modern era, quarantines would be a very, very last resort.
In your book, you say that the World Health Organization is prey to the rising power of private interests. Would you explain?
I think this is happening across our public health sector, is that, you know, we've sort of progressively defunded these agencies. So the UN system in general has been defunded over time. The WHO budget has been defunded over time. And so now they get the majority of their budget shortfall is being replenished by outside funders. And these are NGOs, philanthropies, states. It can be almost anyone. And they can earmark that money, which is what they do. So the majority of the WHO budget is not controlled by the WHO. It's controlled by their outside funders. So all of that is not under sort of international control or democratic control anymore.
And what are the implications for pandemics?
Well, we see already a huge mismatch between public health priorities and what the WHO does with their money. The earmarked funds, which make up somewhere around 80% of the entire budget of the WHO, 91% of those funds are earmarked for diseases that only make up 8% of the global disease burden. So we already see this huge mismatch between what the global health community needs and what the WHO is able to spend their money on.
What effect do pandemics tend to have on social bonds and cooperation?
So this is a really interesting area to look at for me, is how people respond to outbreaks of new disease. And what I found, particularly with cholera, but you know, we saw this again with Ebola, and we see this continuing over time in history, is that these outbreaks of new disease, people don't understand where they come from. People don't understand why they're spreading, why they suddenly arrived. And in the face of that sort of uncertainty and that fear, there's often a lot of scapegoating. And in the 19th century, it was Irish immigrants who were blamed for the cholera. You know, then it was the Muslims that were blamed. Then it was the Eastern Europeans that were blamed. And this wasn't just sort of marginalization and exclusion. It was actually violent. So there was episodes of Irish workers who were quarantined and then secretly slaughtered and buried in mass graves. Doctors were often scapegoated too. And we saw this again with the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, where healthcare workers were attacked during the epidemic. As they were trying to come through to help, they were scapegoated for actually bringing the disease.
How have pandemics shaped humans and helped make us what we are?
So pandemics, you know, one of the main existential threats to any species is pathogens, right? So we have predators, we have pathogens, we have unstable climate that's changeable. And you know, humans have done a pretty good job controlling predators. We've gotten rid of all of our big predators. And we, for better or worse, have sheltered ourselves from major extremes in climate, you know, with our heating and our housing and electricity and all of that. But our fight against pathogens has really just begun. It's only in the last 100 years or so that we've been able to even detect that microbes exist. I mean, these are things that are invisible. And yet they've been exerting a really heavy pressure on our species for, you know, our entire evolution. And in fact, evolutionary biologists, there's theories that it was because of pathogens that we evolved certain parts of our life cycle that are really central. Sexual reproduction, for example, is thought to have evolved as a response to pathogen pressure. That is, the pressure of pathogens continuing to take out certain members of our populations. And one way to kind of get around that was to mix and match our genes so that our offspring would be different than us, even though that means that our offspring only have half of the genes that we have, where if we were cloning, then they would have 100% of our genes. But we don't do that. And there's been interesting studies that have shown that in species that can switch between non-sexual reproduction and sexual reproduction, and there actually are species like that, if you put them in an environment where there are pathogens, they will sexually reproduce. But if you take out those pathogens, then they won't, and they'll clonally reproduce. So there's lots of kind of suggestive evidence like that, that sexual reproduction itself might have evolved as a response to pathogen. And then there's other theories that even death has evolved as a response to pathogens. And that sounds kind of counterintuitive, but in fact, you know, death from a biological perspective is not a necessary thing. You know, microbes don't die. They just keep replicating until something sort of external kills them. They don't have any internal mechanism for diminishing and dying. And, you know, microbes are the first ones who were here, right? They were the first life form. So why are we different? Why do we die? Why is there obsolescence? Why do we get less and less strong and then die over time, even if nothing kills us? And there's a theory called the adaptive theory of aging, which is that this was a response to pathogens, that our populations needed to reduce and diminish over time to avoid, you know, sort of extinction level pandemics, which can happen if you have a clonal population, like they're all the same, right? And so a pathogen that evolves that can take one of those individuals out can then level the entire community. And then from, you know, a 1% left, a standing population that's left, they can repopulate because they're clonally reproducing. But for us, we don't. So we can't afford to have that. We need to have pretty large populations to sustain ourselves over time. Even if there's a large die-off, we won't survive unless we have like a decent number of survivors. So this theory says that the reason that we have obsolescence and death is so that our populations can survive these extinction-leveling pandemics.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sonia Shaw, author of the book, Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond. How have pandemics helped shape human behavior?
Well, there's lots of really interesting examples of people selecting mates, for example, based on immune status. So there's been interesting studies that have shown that whether we are aware of it or not, that we are attracted to people who have different immune genes. So they have different status. Their immunity is different than ours. And one theory is that this would be because we want to heighten the immunity of our children. And this has been shown in their species that individuals want to maximize the diversity of the sort of immune response in their offspring.
How about cultural differences?
So there's a theory that culture itself was in part a response to pathogens. So we know that pathogens sort of adapt to different geographic locations and different populations. So back in the times when there wasn't a lot of population movements, when people kind of lived in the same place for a long time, they would have been highly adapted to local pathogens. You know, that would have been immune responses. Biologically, they would have been more adapted to those pathogens, but also through behaviors, knowing to avoid, say, the swamp at this certain location or these certain foods or, you know, whatever it was. And so there's been some interesting studies that show that when people's reactions to pathogens or fear of pathogens is sort of heightened, that they have more xenophobic responses to other people. And so the theory is that because in the past we would have been highly adapted to our local pathogens, that outsiders would have been quite dangerous for us. They wouldn't know all of these immune behaviors, and they could bring in new pathogens too. And so delineating who we were by tribalism or recognizing our people from them, us and them, and creating new kind of rituals that would define us as opposed to them were important so that we knew who was outsider and who was insider, and this would protect us from these introductions of people who wouldn't know how to avoid the pathogens around us.
In your book, you speak about the hysteria over Ebola, for example, compared to relative nonchalance towards some other diseases, such as Lyme disease. Why are some pathogens feared more than others?
And this is a question that is unanswered, I think. It's that some pathogens somehow we panic about, and some pathogens we just sort of shrug. I think both of those reactions come from the same place, which is a feeling of powerlessness against these uncertain risks. And, you know, so we either deny that it exists or we freak out about it. What we don't do is engage with the risk in an informed way. So they're kind of two flip sides of the same coin. You know, either you kind of deny, oh, it's not happening. This is what we saw in Paris in the 1800s when they used to throw cholera balls, you know, to dress up like cholera itself. And this is during times when there's massive cholera outbreaks. And we saw this again in Florida when there was a dengue outbreak in 2009. There was parades and people would dress up like giant mosquitoes and call themselves dengue fever. You know, there's a band, I think, called Dengue Fever Night or something like that. And it similarly just happened in Brazil during Carnival. You know, people were dressed up like Zika virus. So that's one reaction. But then the other reaction is just to freak out, right? And so this is what happened with what a lot of commentators called Ebola Noia, which is this totally irrational fear that people had across this country that Ebola was going to really take hold in the United States, which was absolutely unfounded because the way we live, you know, is not conducive to the spread of Ebola. And yet, you know, there was communities that were not allowing teachers who had visited a meeting in a hotel that was 2 miles away from a hospital where one Ebola patient was, they weren't allowed to come back to their schools for weeks on end. They had to be quarantined because of this panic idea about Ebola. And I think in part it's also because we didn't have good treatments. And as Americans, we have a lot of faith in biomedicine. You know, we always feel like the doctors will come up with something to save us, a drug, a vaccine. There's always something, right, that can be done. And the fact that for Ebola, there wasn't anything, I think was, you know, really deeply unsettling. Also, it's an exotic disease from this faraway place. But there's a number of different reasons why we have these sort of disparate responses.
How is climate change likely to affect pandemics?
Well, we already see that climate change is allowing disease vectors to spread. So mosquitoes, ticks, these creatures are able to take over new territory. And, you know, we've seen with the Zika virus that the mosquitoes that carry that virus or capable of carrying that virus have been really dramatically expanding their range in recent years. And that's thanks in part to climate change, also to urban expansion in those places. So this is happening with a lot of vector-borne diseases. We see that with tick-borne illnesses as well, that they're spreading into new places. I mean, we have malaria in Greece now, in parts of Italy. These diseases that once were kind of beaten back into the tropics, into the poor tropics, are now kind of resurging back. And that's in large part being driven by climate changes.
What steps can we take to address emerging pandemics?
I think there's a lot we can do. I think there's a lot of technical things we can do. But I think the big missing piece in this is public pressure. You know, I think as communities, we need to sort of take hold of our public health and understand the risks of the pathogens around us and how our behaviors contribute to that risk. So we can do a lot more with surveillance. We can find pathogens before they start to spread. We have that technical capacity now. I think that kind of work should be funded. And then, of course, we need to address really deep-seated issues. We need to address poverty. We need to address the lack of sanitation in a lot of the world. We have about 2.6 billion people today living without sanitation. That's a huge risk for all of us now. A lot of our animals live in the equivalent of slums as well. I mean, we have more animals under domestication today than in the last 10,000 years of domestication combined, up until 1960 combined. Huge numbers. And we keep a lot of them in these factory farms where there's a million or more individuals crowded closely together. And, you know, that creates a huge opportunity for pathogens to emerge and to spread and to become more virulent. And we've already seen this. So these are things we can address, right? The health of the most vulnerable among us, that is people who live in slums, people who live in poverty, animals in the, you know, animal equivalent of slums. These are all things that we could do to help reduce the risk of pathogens, not just emerging, but that they don't get the opportunity to spread very far when they do.
Which organisms are of most concern for causing pandemics at present?
Well, I think if you asked a bunch of emerging disease experts, they'd each have their own answer to that question. But the ones that I most commonly heard, one was a novel kind of influenza. And that's because every year we have a, you know, seasonal influenza pandemics. And a lot of people die in those. And that's because they spread so easily among us. That's the way we live. We cough on each other. We breathe on each other. We don't stay home when we're sick. We don't wash our hands. You know, so these things can spread really easily among us. Most of them, we have some immunity to. So the mortality rate is really low. But what we're seeing out of, particularly in Asia, because that's where a lot of wild waterfowl live, and those are the reservoirs of avian influenza, of all influenzas, you know, the growth of factory farming in that area is allowing these viruses to mutate in new ways. And some of those are evolving in ways that can infect humans. Now, if one of those was able to spread around us the way seasonal influenza is, even if it had a really slightly higher mortality rate, it could take out a lot of people. So new kinds of influenza are certainly one answer to your question. But the other one is antibiotic-resistant bacteria, these superbugs that are emerging with increasing frequency. And so far, a lot of these antibiotic resistance genes that we've seen out there have not come into a pathogen that can easily spread among us. But once that happens, you know, it really would change the face of medicine, because there's very few, I mean, besides life and death surgeries, most doctors wouldn't take the risk of doing sort of a knee replacement or, you know, some simple kinds of surgeries that right now are routine. We wouldn't take the risk because the risk would be of an absolutely untreatable bacterial infection. There would be nothing that could be used for it. So that would really change the face of medicine, and with it, you know, a lot of other things too. So those super resistant bugs are another major threat, I think, for a lot of emerging disease experts.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
What I hope my book would accomplish, besides being just a good story, because it is an amazing story, is to help people understand where pathogens come from and to look at the way we live and how does our human health connect to the health of our animals and the health of our wildlife and the health of our societies, the health of our ecosystems. And I think the history of pandemics really shows that, in fact, all of those things are connected.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Sonia.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You are just listening to Sonia Shaw, author of the book Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond, published in 2016 by Sarah Crichton Books. For more information, check on the web at soniashaw.com. That's soniashah.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM by Mobile App and on kexp.org.